Coming up on This Week in Enterprise Tech, Sandy spikes a fiber upgrade, DC in the DC, and we're all about the disaster. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 21, recorded December 3rd, 2012. The shocking truth about DC. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, a powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by Social Media Solutions from SAP. If you're a social media manager at a large enterprise, gain insight and engage in social media in a systematic way with Social Media Solutions from SAP. Learn more at sap.com/twit. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester. I'm the digital Jesuit, and I am joined by, as always, a panel of the usual suspects, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the evangelist from Thin Links and the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how is the geek in paradise?
The geek in paradise is very tired. I was up late last night working on a failed server. In fact, I'm actually going to be using Paragon software to do a restore after we get off the air.
Now, that's a spoiler, so be careful. We don't want to give them too much of a hint before we get there. Also joining us is another of the usual suspects, a wealth of knowledge, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, are you still in Florida?
I am, in fact, in Florida, where we're enjoying above-average temperatures. It's actually about 80 degrees here in North Florida, so we're having a great time. The sandhill cranes are migrating in, and all is right with the world. I'm getting ready to head out for Dell World for next week, so putting on my Austin shoes.
Yeah, I don't know what's up with the weather. I just came back from Orlando yesterday, and when I left, it was 79 degrees and beautiful, so I'm not sure if winter has actually arrived, but let's put that aside for now because we've got plenty of news in the Enterprise Byte. Starting with, and I'm sure the two of you have heard this, the official pricing of the Surface Pro. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but we do have to talk about it because this has been one of the promised saviors of Microsoft's tablet strategy. Brian, Curtis, what do you think? We're talking $899 for the 64-gigabyte version and just under $1,000 with the 128-gigabyte version. Is this going to change the game? Now that you have the Surface RT, you have Windows 8, and you have the Surface Pro, which is essentially Windows 8 in a tablet format, is this going to give Microsoft an added boost?
No, it's too expensive.
I think that's
too expensive.
I think I'll be a little more nuanced than that. I think if you're going to judge success by the blocks, long lines outside the Microsoft stores, then it's a failure. If, on the other hand, you're looking at a slow build as companies and individuals decide gradually to update their tablets, then it could be a long-term success. I know a lot of people are disappointed by the pricing. But one of the things that we found is that if you're going to build a fully featured tablet, you're going to have to charge somewhere between $600 and $1,000 for it. Everyone is coming in that ballpark.
I think the most disappointing thing for me was, you know, the pricing of both the Pro and the RT seemed not aggressive enough, especially that Microsoft is an outsider here. I mean, let's face it. They are having their lunches eaten by both Apple and Google. So it seems as if they had, say, priced the RT in the $300, $350 range and priced the Pro in the $600 to $700 range, they'd be clearing up. I mean, and a lot of the info was saying that that wouldn't be a loss. It might be more or less a break even, but at least they'd be getting market share. It seems as if they're saying, well, because it's Windows, you're just going to buy it. Now, I will admit this. I have been using this for the past week or so. This is an Acer S7 Ultrabook. It's, you know, it's Windows 8. And I have to say, I used to think the screen was just sort of a gimmick. It was just something that they could get me to pay extra for. I have learned to just really like it. It works well, especially as a news reader. And not only that, the touchscreen is really effective in close quarters, something like a plane. Now, whether or not this is worth the $1,000 premium that you would pay over a similarly priced, a similarly equipped notebook is still yet to be seen. But what I see in the Surface Pro is a competitive notebook, if not necessarily top of the line. Brian, what is Microsoft going to need to push this, to really tell enterprises that this is the tablet you're going to want for your executives?
It's going to be all about apps. There's an awful lot of apps that are from small software shops that are having trouble expending the resources to change over their apps to meet the new standards and also go through the digital signature process to get it onto the App Store. The Surface Pro, at least you supposedly can install not from, you know, apps other than the App Store, but a lot of it's going to be driven by what apps are available, whether or not they're going to actually have partnerships with people like Cisco, Juniper, and so forth for things like VPNs. That's actually one of the more active forums on the Windows Surface blog.
Yeah, I actually admit that I like the fact that some programs work better as apps. Like my news readers work much better as apps, and yet I still have access to all the software I did when I was running just Windows 7. That's a nice touch, and it's something that I think they should be emphasizing much more than they are at the moment. Curtis, same question to you, and let's make this the last word on the topic, and that is, what does Microsoft have to do to really push the Surface Pro? RT had Office baked into it, Pro, not so much.
Well, I think that Brian is quite correct. Apps are going to be key. But also we have to keep in mind that Microsoft is walking a tightrope that Apple doesn't have to walk. Microsoft still derives the bulk of its income from its partners. And so it had to come in with a product that set a functional standard but still allowed room for those partners to succeed. I think they've done that. And I think that ultimately the question of Surface's success is going to be wrapped in the success of Windows 8 as a whole.
Oh, and in that sense, maybe this could be Microsoft's version of the Nexus line with Android. Them saying that this is a baseline. This is what we would like you to design for the next generation of these devices. If they could release Surface RTs and Surface Pros over the next couple of years that sort of drive the vendors to innovate, then maybe that is all they need to succeed. Now, let's move on. I want to talk a little bit more about Sandy because this is a topic that, is near and dear to a lot of IT geeks' hearts, especially if they're living in the Northeast. This is a story from The Verge about, what happened to the Broad Street Telecom vault below the streets of New York during Hurricane Sandy. The story here is that we've got infrastructure that has been in place for decades, absolutely ancient, old. Some of this has not been marked up except by tags that, honestly have worn down and really have no information that they communicate to today's IT engineers. So when the vaults got flooded for days, almost a week in some places, you had engineers who had to go back down in the hole. You had to dry out these vaults. And then they had to do things like searching through conduits with infrared meters to find the places where they had shorts. In the end, it looks like they had to pull out all the old copper and replace it with fiber, which is a good thing. And that leads me to my question of discussion. Cheever, does it take a disaster like this for a major metropolitan area to do an upgrade of ancient infrastructure.
It shouldn't, but it seems to be. A good example close to home for me is on Kauai after Hurricane Iniki came through. Kauai had some of the worst telecom infrastructure in the Hawaiian island chain, and after Iniki went through and ripped up all their infrastructure and had to put all new poles and so forth, suddenly they now have the best infrastructure in Hawaii. DSL Platinum is awesome on Kauai.
Curtis, what do you think? I mean, this is one of those weird instances where the disaster has forced Verizon to do something that they've been very reluctant to do in the past, and that is to run a new network, essentially, because they had all the copper and it was working. So it was hard for them to argue that they should invest millions, if not tens or hundreds of millions of dollars into building up a parallel infrastructure. Now that the infrastructure is destroyed, they're forced to run new fiber and new conduits.
Well, I think it calls to mind an old saying that the good enough is the enemy of the best. And we've seen that in a lot of areas in North America, other places in the world as well, but particularly in North America, where we were an early leader in technology. And because the infrastructure was put in place, we've never really evolved, or we've evolved very slowly. Something like this is forcing them to do things that, frankly, the company should have done years ago. And I think that what this serves as, more than anything else, is a wake-up call to every telecom that has a presence in a low-lying coastal community. And that, frankly, is most of the majors. We know that these kinds of disasters can happen. We know what the consequences are. We know that most telecom infrastructure is below ground in most of these cities. So the obvious lesson is go ahead, move to fiber, bite the bullet now, and that way you keep things up and look like heroes after the disaster strikes.
A side story is the fact that Verizon did have some fiber infrastructure in place, and it survived. I mean, yeah, they lost the switches and the transceivers and the SFP modules that they needed to pump that out to individual customers, but they were able to replace that equipment relatively easy, download the old configurations that had been saved to the central office, and be back up and running. Chibert, what is the durability of fiber over copper? I mean, you do this a lot because you lay undersea cable. Are we talking about a significant strategic advantage to having fiber in place over the old copper?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. There's many, many cases where you've had fiber submerged for years, decades, not even fiber that's designed to be submerged, just regular old zip cord, and it still works. About the only problem I've ever had is mold. You know, mold grows in and eventually cracks the fiber, but that's a very long process, and it just happens. Fiber is just more robust when it comes to that type of thing, but it's easier to break than copper. So 6-1, half a dozen the other, I don't know. Hard to tell.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, yeah, there are definitely technical challenges to rolling out fiber. There's definitely a cost issue. But if you look at something like disaster preparedness, I don't think anyone's going to argue that copper is going to be more robust, other than to say that in like a plain old telephone system, you can still get a dial tone, whereas with fiber, the system would be out. Curtis, on your side, dealing with enterprise efficiency, every new deployment, you just assume that it's going to have fiber everywhere that's possible, right?
I think that is, for most enterprises, the default these days. Now, you have to admit, there are companies, especially in the mid-size and the smaller end of the spectrum, where the cost advantages of copper when it comes to install costs tend to let them lean in that direction. But for most major enterprises, and certainly for every company that's concerned about serious performance or a seriously robust infrastructure, fiber is the way to go.
Speaking of robust infrastructure, I think that's a good time to speak about one of our sponsors. That's Citrix with GoToMeeting with HD Faces. Now, I'm big on tech. That's no surprise. I'm a geek. I'm a mega geek. I'm a King Kamehameha-sized geek. And I like to be connected at all times. And that means I use the latest and the greatest communication tools. But nothing quite replaces that face-to-face meeting. You know, it's catching that little eye rise or the the slightly crooked smile, or maybe some other piece of body language that lets you know what someone else is thinking. We need these face-to-face meetings if we're going to do business, if we're going to collaborate, if we're going to do business right. And, well, it's not always possible. In fact, it's well known that our nonverbal communication says far more than our words. Our gestures, body movement, and subtle cues can help us communicate and get things done. So when our team or our colleague or our client is in a different building, a different city, or a different country, we could use audio-only conference calling and forsake all nonverbal communication. We could demand that our team, our client, our collaborators come together, robbing them of time and resources. Or we could try GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, a powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate online. This isn't just an exercise for me. I use GoToMeeting with HD Faces in my podcasting work. I do a podcast called The Book Guys, which is led by Paul Alvis up in Canada. We've got geeks everywhere to talk about books, to talk about podcasts, to talk about comics, things that we hold near and dear. Now, it's a simple weekly audio-only podcast, but we spent most of our time fiddling with the various ways to get high-quality audio back to the studio. Now, not too long ago, the crew was on its last nerve. Things weren't working right. We were getting a lot of echo, so I suggested GoToMeeting with HD Faces. After all, it was good for my team meetings. I thought it should work for a podcast. Since that first day, we haven't looked back. GoToMeeting not only gave us a high-quality audio link, but it also made scheduling our shows as easy as sending an email. We also love the fact that GoToMeeting installs on an iPad. It installs with a simple client on a Mac or a PC that someone can join by calling in. It makes everything possible because it runs on everything. Not only has GoToMeeting made our shows much easier to produce, but we found that we have a video interface which allows us to increase the quality of the show. By seeing each other in HD, it's easy for us to riff off of one another, to get in the vibe. In other words, to communicate. We swear by GoToMeeting, and I know you will too. Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Don't wait. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Remember to use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Cheever, you run a lot of data center work. So tell me, have you heard of DC in the DC?
DC in what? DC in the data center?
That's right. What does that refer to?
DC is one of those weird technologies that the telecom guys have been running forever and ever and ever. But the data center guys don't seem to like it very much. Now, with the change in how much electricity costs and how much cooling costs and so forth, there's renewed interest. But the problem is when you start running lower voltages, like negative 48 volts or something like that, you can't have really long power runs like you can with, say, 208. And you lose a lot of efficiency. So what you're looking at is, gee, how the heck do I get that and not lose all the efficiency when I have to do long runs? Does that mean I've got to put 48 volt transformers in every rack? I'm not sure. So the data center world isn't sure either, and everybody's in a wait and see stage.
And while we're waiting and seeing, let's take a look at stuff my IT guy says. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, host of TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the TWiET Network. And you've stumbled into another edition of Stuff My IT Guy Says. This time I'm speaking to Mr. Calvin Nicholson from ServerTech. Calvin, thank you very much for coming on.
Appreciate being here.
We're here at Interop, and you're here to introduce a topic to our audience that is probably going to become more and more popular as time goes on, and that is DC power in the data center.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. So we're used to this. These switch CDUs that step down from either 1, 2, or 3 phase power and give 120, 60 hertz power to our servers, to our switches, to our out-of-band management devices, whatever we need in the rack.
Yeah.
But we're seeing the rise of DC power.
Sure.
Why
sure,
is that?
Sure. I think overall, power costs are continuing to go up. And in many markets, power availability is going down. So there's a need to drive efficiency. We've seen that on the three-phase side, 400-volt power solutions, as one way to drive efficiency. There is a firm belief that you can use DC power, don't do any of the conversions through the UPS, and bring 380-volt power DC directly to the devices.
Okay, now I understand the difference between AC and DC. So AC is an alternating current, you have the sine wave thing.
DC is
you've got a positive side and a negative side.
A go
side and a return side.
Yep.
Now, 380 volts, that sounds kind of dangerous. I know DC power can kill you a bit easier than AC. Why would I want 380 DC in my data center?
Well, 380 is actually, the way it's being delivered in these new applications is plus and minus 190.
Oh.
So it's actually not really as bad as 380 volts. Also, 380 volts was selected because, believe it or not, that's the DC voltage that AC coming into a server is originally converted to.
Oh.
So you don't need to do those conversions even within the server initially.
So basically, you've just removed a whole chunk out of the back of each device.
Well, you've removed a whole chunk out of your data center infrastructure on the UPS and that side of things. So there's an argument that a DC solution could be more reliable. There's less moving parts. And then you've increased some efficiency in bringing it directly into the devices and kind of taking a chunk out of there. Yes.
Now, I understand the concept. So our computers, our servers, our switches, they all run on DC.
They do.
There's no AC running around the motherboard.
No, not once you get inside.
And so it makes sense that if I can provide the DC, I'm cutting out that whole AC loop within the data center, and that brings up efficiencies. But why didn't we do this a long time ago? It seems to me that we should have tried this even before AC.
You know, there's been a strong argument and an understanding that we've needed to get more efficient. The data centers and these industrial processes, we know, are the factories of the future, right? They're going to power our success, our growth, and we're seeing that. So the need to get more efficient, the need to reduce your costs, the need to get more competitive is driving some innovative solutions. One of the innovative solutions, 380 volt DC. We really needed two things. We needed to standardize on a voltage. Turns out 380 is a very good choice. And there's been a lot of advancements in connectors and standardizing on connectors. So we've got a voltage, we've got a connector. So now we've got some standards that servers, manufacturers, and other people can work from in building their devices.
Now let's get down to the nitty-gritty. To an IT exec or an IT professional out there who is looking at the changeover to DC, what are the things that he or she would have to do? I mean, what do you have to change over before you can seriously consider a total DC data center solution? And what are the expected returns? I mean, what have you been seeing?
So I think there's a couple things here. One, in the same way that everybody talks about 120-volt devices being dead in the data center, they still seem to slip in there. So even people that are going 208, three-phase, 400 volts, all of a sudden there's still this odd demand for 120-volt power. So obviously we know the same thing's going to happen on the DC side. You're not going to have all the devices that you want to put in your data center available at 380 volts. So I think you're going to see high-volume devices like servers, and many of the manufacturers right now have devices that will run on 380-volt DC. So I think for the data center, it's going to be a little bit of a transition. You still may have some AC racks for certain things. You will have your DC racks where there's devices that are available. And I think that will be a little bit more of a hybrid design, I guess is what I'm getting at, than believing that you can just go in and create a 380-volt data center right off the bat. It's not really practical today. As far as the gains, there are gains in efficiency. I've heard double-digit numbers. I've heard all the way down to just a few percent. I think the truth is probably someplace in the middle. We're going to have to get some of these built, run them, and really see where the overall value is.
Well, there you have it. That's the reason for the DC data center. Thank you very much for coming on.
Appreciate
again.
It.
And if they want to find out more about what ServerTech is doing with DC power, where should they go?
www.servertech.com. We have built some 380-volt products and have them at some concept and labs and proof centers around, working with some other partners we've got. So there are solutions out there if you're interested in 380 volts.
I'm Father Robert Ballas here. This is Stuff My IT Guy Says, and you've just been learned.
So that's DC in the DC. Curtis, dealing with enterprise efficiency, do you hear a lot of DC talk? I mean, every data center is always trying to increase their efficiencies. And this sounds like the next logical step. I mean, if you can take the AC to DC conversion, put it at the start of the data center rather than in each rack, you do everything from increasing efficiencies of power transformation to decreasing cooling needs. Is this a hot topic, or is this one of those things that people just sort of push to the back burner?
Well, I think you pegged it just right when you said it could be the next big topic, because it's not the current big topic. I think it's one of those things that people are beginning to look at. There are a lot of reasons they are beginning to look at it. We've heard about a lot of those in the video we've just had. There are still a lot of questions that people want to answer, especially, I think, in the larger data centers, where the question of exactly where you do that conversion becomes critically important. As Brian mentioned when he was talking about it earlier, DC has a lot of advantages. Running efficiently over long distances isn't one of them. And so the point at which you do the conversion is critical, unless you like the idea of electrical cables the size of your thigh running around the data center floor.
Brian, what about that? Because, I mean, I was serious. That much DC power does sort of scare the pants off of me. I mean, I've seen what even a low DC arc can do. Now, let's talk 380 volts. We're talking about some serious damage potential here. How do we address that? I mean, do we just have to increase our awareness and our vigilance of power safety protocol? Or is there a good technology out there that's going to make DC data centers not death traps?
Well, it's a lot of it's going to be about the connectors and how you do that. Negative 48 tends to have a lot of open posts and nuts and bolts and so forth. And Omega Project was actually mentioning he's got a scar the size of a silver dollar from getting hit with negative 48. You know, we've run it at Interop, especially with the MPLS guys. They had a whole bunch of negative 48, and we actually managed to set a power box on fire because we were pulling so much power. But negative 48 and the connectors is going to be key, because when you plug in a lot of different things, there's nothing like a big-ass arc that's going to scare the pants off a data center person and force them to think twice about ever touching it again. So I think it's all about connectors and all about making sure that it's a no-arc situation.
Yeah. Calvin was right in saying that 380 is the voltage to which most boxes in the IT world convert their voltage to. I mean, when you go from AC to DC, 380 is sort of the breakout voltage, but it's contained within a power supply. It's contained within a cage that is grounded. Once you start taking that 380 and you break it out over a rack or multiple racks or a building the size of a football field, you're right. Both of you are right in that it's very important where you do the transformation, and it's also very important how you contain that voltage. Now, even with all of that, would either of you like to argue against being DC in the DC being the next step as we move to the truly efficient data center?
No, I'd actually argue against, especially since one of the things that a lot of people are talking about is using condenser water for direct cooling of CPUs and GPUs and things like that. And really high voltage DC combined with fluid, ooh, that really scares the pants off me.
Curtis? I don't know. I'm going to take the opposing view, and I'm going to say that DC in the DC is going to become more common. And I tell you what I think will be one of the big drivers. That's the push towards locally produced renewable energy. We're seeing a lot more large data centers doing things like putting photovoltaic cells all over the roof, siting wind power on premises. All of that tends to generate naturally in DC. So you have to do a DC to AC conversion. Now, if they can avoid doing the DC to AC to deep back to DC, they're ahead of the game. I think it's going to play with the way people have to learn their data distribution. And interestingly enough, I think this provides a real opportunity for all of those people in college in a traditional electrical engineering curriculum. We've seen those folks, the numbers drop off over the last 30 years as people went entirely into things like electronics. now the notion of designing the distribution of DC power, the generation locally of the power, becomes much more feasible and much more important. You know, we're really seeing, I think, the revenge of Nikola Tesla coming forth in the Green Revolution.
Curtis, I think you just came up with the show title. But I love the fact that the two of you come down on different sides of this, because if you look at the chat room right now, they're pretty equally divided. On one side, you have the people who are who is that? Bosco is saying that you're right on with the local power generation. You know, now that it's feasible to generate your power locally, it makes sense to keep things in D.C. You've got other guys who have actually done work in the field who are saying, yeah, 380 volts D.C. scares the pants off of them. So I think we're kind of seeing one of those classic, would be great if it was feasible, not sure if I want to do it in real life type of debates. And that's when good things happen in the IT world. I want to give the last word here to Brian. Chiebert, as you do actually build your own DCs on a regular basis, are you going to start testing out any DC-only equipment? I mean, I know that a lot of the gear that we play with has options for DC power. But do you plan on doing a shootout, or is there even enough gear to do a shootout in the near future?
No, not enough gear for a shootout, but I have been approached by one or two corporations that are saying, we'd like to show you our new DC racks, and they don't look anything like the 19-inch equipment racks that we're used to. You actually start hanging things. Think of a pegboard, and when you attach the physical connector on the back, it kind of swings into place, almost like a big knife switch, but all the connectors are surrounded by insulators, so you don't have any arc over. That looks really interesting, especially since it gives you more room around the rack, so that maybe towards the front of the server equipment, you can start having condenser water direct cooling.
Fantastic. All right. Well, again, this is one of those topics that hopefully we'll hear more about. We definitely want to see what DC can do in a real life infrastructure. I'm actually hoping that Interop might take on DC and the DC at some point in the near future, and I'll actually get to play with 380 volts and live. I think me wanting to live is a good time for us to take a break and talk about another one of our sponsors, SAP. Now, if you are in a small to medium business, to a regional enterprise, you know that the conversation is all in social media today. When we talk about the value of a brand, when we talk about the reputation that a particular product has, it's all because of what we hear in the social media. It's about what someone puts on their Facebook page or a tweet that makes it around the world, or what some blogger writes in his latest review on X Gizmo or Y Gadget. We need to be able to understand, to comprehend, and then to respond to what's happening in the social media space. And that's why we want to take a look at social media solutions from SAP. It's common for people to complain or comment about brands in public. Social media solutions from SAP helps us to understand that by breaking it down into two components. The first component is called their listening component. Think of it as AI for social media. It looks at what's being said about your brand. It captures and reports on conversations and relevant terms, passions, patterns, and even about your competitors. It surfaces sentiment and the intensity of it. For example, it tells you if your customers like, love, or dislike something that you're doing. It helps you to build better products by incorporating real-time customer feedback into your innovation efforts. And it helps you identify customers who are ready to buy. This is my favorite part. It looks at their buying signals, what they're writing, where they're going, and it uses natural language processing to intelligently and automatically know when they're ready to pull the trigger. Now, the engaging component is the second part of SAP's social media solution service. It helps you improve customer support by allowing you to set rules about which messages route to whom and how they should be dealt with. For example, if someone were to tweet a technical support problem, it will automatically route it to one of your engineers so that their problem can be fixed through and on social media, improving your brand and, improving the customer experience support. Social media solutions from SAP gives you an accurate and real-time understanding of your brand's social media performance. And in today's world, that's all about the game. If you manage the social media presence for a large, regional, or national enterprise, get in touch with SAP today. You can find out more by going to sap.com/twit and we thank SAP for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get to the meat of the episode. That's right, we're talking all about disasters. We've got Mr. Francisco Gillette from Paragon Software Group. Francisco, tell us a little bit about yourself and who you represent.
Yes, I'm with Paragon Software Group. We provide disaster recovery solutions for small business up to enterprise. We also have a personal disaster recovery solutions that we provide. I've been in the backup industry for over 5 years now, in the IT field for over 10 years. Dealing with disaster recovery. I've lived in Florida and in Washington, D.C., so always disaster recovery has been, always a concern for all the companies I've been with.
Now, Francisco, this is sort of a universal truth anytime we talk about disaster preparedness or disaster recovery, and that is we typically only think about those two topics when it's too late. We all know that it's good to be prepared for disaster. We all know that it's good to have your data backed up. But if you believe the stats, and alarmingly few of us actually do it, why do you think that is?
People, I guess, think that, it's not going to happen to them. The disaster is not going to happen to them, with whatever they're doing, they're safe. As we've seen in Sandy and other natural disasters, it can happen to anybody. Last year in Washington, D.C., there was an earthquake. So it can happen anywhere, so really everybody needs to be prepared.
Right. Okay. Well, let's get down to the nitty gritty here. Tell me, what would you say is the best practice for ensuring the integrity of your data in a disaster? So this is before the disaster. This is during your planning stages. Let's say I'm planning for the next Sandy, or I'm planning for the next hurricane. I'm planning for the next earthquake. I'm planning for the next fire because, it's going to happen. What are the steps that I have to take to make sure that the data that is most vital to my enterprise, to my business, is going to survive?
The first step is to just have a backup. The disaster recovery backup, there's different levels of backup. There's file level backup and there's disaster recovery backup. Disaster recovery allows you to get your system completely back up and running. Whether it's on the same hardware in the event of hardware, hard drive failure, or completely different environment, whether it's virtual or another physical system, or even in the cloud, you can expand on that by sending those backups or those images offsite, so you have a secondary location. If it's a business, you can send it to another part of the country that, may have a different type of disaster or maybe away from disasters. Or you can go to the cloud. The cloud is not as susceptible to damage from natural disasters because there's built-in redundancies there. So you can definitely increase your availability and your ability to be back up online based on, how robust your disaster recovery strategy is.
I think that's actually a very important distinction to make, because when we typically talk about backup, most of us think of individual backups. So I back up the data that I have on my workstation here. I make sure I have all my videos on a server that's in a DC somewhere that I don't have to worry about. But there is also that recovery element of the backup, which is if I need to restore to a system because my original setup was destroyed, we're not talking about just accidental deletion of data. We're talking about actual destruction of location. It's a slightly different planning process, is it not?
That's correct, yes. Especially with businesses running applications, e-commerce, if they just have a backup of their database, that's great, but that's not going to get their business back up and running. They have to have, that same system running, somewhere else so that they can, take advantage of being up and running and not losing any of that business.
All right. Okay, so let's take it to the next logical step. Let's say I have backup. I have backup both of individual data somewhere in a cloud, somewhere maybe let's say it's call it a private cloud. I've got it on a private cloud. I've got it on physical servers located around the country. And I've also got a restore backup, a disaster preparedness backup, so that I can actually restore, say, the setup of my office. What are the steps that I have to take so that I could actually use that? In other words, what do I have to do to enable fast relocation and recovery of services to actually run my business, not just have the data available to me?
Right. Depending on the solution, you can restore to different hardware. So you can take an image that was maybe created on a Dell server, and if that server is no longer available, be able to restore that to different hardware. It's called hardware independent restores. They also have the ability to take that same image and create a virtual instance of it or a virtual machine. That way, again, it's hardware independent. You can run it off of different hardware. You don't have to have that specific machine available for that recovery of that system.
I want to bring in one of our panelists at this time. Curtis, is this something that you hear enterprises rehearsing for? I mean, do they actually prepare with data backup and with recovery backup so that they can, say, move operations to a location 2,000 miles away when there's a disaster at one site? Curtis, you're muted.
Thank you. This is something that companies tend to do when they're forced to, often by a contract that they have with a data recovery service. I know I've talked to companies that have contracts with a company like SunGard, with a company like IBM Global Business Recovery. They really require their customers to rehearse these. And the rehearsal is critical because when part of your relocation plan involves taking backup tapes and putting them on a chartered jet along with key members of your IT staff, you can't depend on everyone doing it just right if they've never done it before. Doing things like rehearsal also allows you to answer critical questions like, if you've got a disaster and you're sending your team, what do you do with their families? Do you ask an IT professional to leave his family back where the disaster is ongoing, or do you send the family along with them? You've got to consider these. You've got to practice it. And far too many companies never get around to it until it's too late.
Chibert, what about you? So you work with the university, and I know that the university has plans for disasters and plans for data relocation, especially for a lot of their academic research. What kind of disaster recovery plans do you typically have in place?
Well, I'll tell you, a lot of universities don't have disaster recovery plans. When many, many years ago, we had a Halloween night flood that wiped out lots and lots and lots of buildings. And that's when I really found out how poorly university professors are at planning this type of thing. They're running on really, really tight budgets and having hot sites or warm sites or even getting backups off-site doesn't always tend to happen because they're not IT professionals. Now, our IT group did have stuff off-site, which is a really cool thing. They had it on Neighbor Island, and they also had it on the mainland. I personally am really enamored with the Utah salt mines and tend to go and put long-term archiving there. A lot of people need to start thinking about where the heck are you going to put things? Yes, practice, practice, practice. If you don't practice, you're going to find yourself thumbing through manuals and possibly making mistakes because you've never done it before. Spend a little bit of time, that next server that you are getting ready to deploy, try to do restore. Practice first.
Now, just a point of clarification for our slightly geek challenged members of the audience. When you say hot site and warm site, you're specifically referring to?
I'm referring to being able to immediately flip over and start running on a hot site. And a warm site is a system where the equipment matches, it's ready to spin up, but you still need to do a restore to it. And then a cold site is probably a bare room with just an agreement for people to ship in gear on a very quick basis. Hot, warm, cold, depends on how much money you have to spend and how critical business down is to you.
Exactly. So the hotter the room is, the more it's going to cost. Because if you're running a hot site, it essentially means that you're paying twice for your office versus, a contingency plan. Francisco, I want to go back to you. When you hear this, when you hear about what Enterprise has to do, when they talk about actually relocating families and offices, when you hear about academia, well, first of all, it's scary that many of them are not having a disaster recovery plan. And when they're also considering hot, warm, and cold sites, how does that fit into your idea of best practices? How does that fit into what the Paragon Software Group does to allow entities to plan for disaster recovery?
Our software is very scalable. So depending on the level, because there is not one standard fit for every business out there. So depending on what your needs are, you may need that hot site or a cold site will work. Another location or business another office location to send the data. So really depends. There is no standard. But definitely having offsite or a secondary location is key. Redundancy is key. Having that backup in more than one location is always good. It really depends. There's lots of things to manage, budget, and a lot of other things to consider, like the recovery time objective and recovery point objectives. How soon do you need to be back up and running? How old of a backup can your system go back to and still function? So lots of considerations. It really depends on the business, which is best for them.
That's actually a great point, because in an ideal world, we would be backing up all the time. We would be ready with a hot spot, a hot location, so that we can immediately bring back our infrastructure and bring back our operating systems and our network systems. But we don't live in that world. We live in the real world where those things cost money. So what would be the guidelines that, say, you've come up with that guide people's decisions into how many resources they're going to put into disaster recovery, into how they're going to structure their recovery plans, into how they're going to actually back up data and the associated information so that they can actually recover from a disaster when it eventually happens?
Basically, it's kind of a monetary equation there. If being offline costs you money, and not being up and running, then you need to spend more money to get back up and running. So, banks and e-commerce sites have to spend that extra money so that, they don't go down. That's how they bring in money. If they're not online, it costs them money. So, the factor is, if it affects money coming in, then you definitely need to spend on that infrastructure so you can make that money, so you can keep profits coming in.
Reverb Mike in the chat room actually makes an excellent point. He said that his boss did not authorize him to replace a $12 part on a generator, and as a result, it cost them $12,000 when Sandy hit. And I think it's that sort of short-sightedness that often catches people when we talk about disaster recovery. And I think it sort of taps into the human psyche here. If everything's fine right now, then why do I have to muck with it? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Curtis, what objective truths can you offer us about preparedness for disasters?
Well, the number one is that you have to admit that a disaster can take place. The second is that you have to take a hard look at the value of the operations. In other words, does everything have an equal value to your organization? And third, you have to be willing to protect the things that are most valuable and to continue preparing for their protection. a lot of people are very happy to give lip service to the importance of everything they do. But when it comes down to putting money on the table, you find that either they are bigger gamblers than they'd like their shareholders to believe, or that things really aren't that important. It's critical to protect what's important, to understand what's important, and to admit that on any given day, those important operations could be devastatingly affected by something entirely beyond your control.
Chiebert, what do you think about that? I actually like the point that Curtis made about prioritizing what needs to be protected. Because, yeah, let's be honest, there's some information in our enterprise, there's some information in our network that we could really do without. And then there's other pieces that are vital. But it seems to me that in most network setups I've seen, there's not a really clear delineation between the stuff that absolutely must be saved and the stuff that, well, it's a lesser priority. We don't really design our networks for that, do we?
No, not really. The closest thing I've ever seen is how people are almost from the beginning, storage area networks have gotten their own physical networks so they have significantly higher bandwidth to move things around. SANs in general have had backup built in, usually to very large tapes. I happen to really like optical, just because in Hawaii or any high humidity environment, mold and mildew are the number one enemy of tape. Lifespan of a magnetic tape in Hawaii is only about 1.5 to 2 years. So you got to make sure you trade it out. But yeah, there's not enough planning being done. One of the things I want people to think about is maybe you don't need to restore everything right at the very beginning. Maybe you might want to consider bringing things back in stages. You know, someone's puppy picture collection can probably wait a week or so.
I don't know. My puppy pictures are pretty important, but that's just me. Francisco, let me bring it back to you, because Chiebert makes a great point about, having the ability to divest your information, your backups into different media. As far as what media you use for the backup, I mean, you've already mentioned that you'd store things offsite in the cloud. But as far as physical media, do you have a best practices guide for that?
Yeah, hard drives are pretty much the mainstream now. A lot of people are moving away from tapes because of the same things Brian mentioned. There's been studies done that, you know, up to about 50% of tape stores don't even work just because of, you know, tapes get broken. People don't maintain their tapes. So the whole trend is totally moving away from tapes. Backing up to physical discs is pretty much the norm and the standard now.
We had the great story out of my own enterprise. I'm not going to name it. We had a university that did a tape backup, and we actually had a student intern who was paid throughout the years to swap the tapes. He kept getting an error message that there was something wrong with the tapes, but that wasn't part of his job. He just knew he had to swap the tapes whenever the light stopped blinking. And so we eventually needed to use the tape backup, and nothing worked. I mean, they hadn't worked for years. We went back through some of the logs, and it had been, I think, 2 years from the start of the first tape going bad. But because we hadn't planned for it, because we never actually told the intern, you should probably tell us if there are error messages popping up, it never got fixed. And it seems to me that there are so many backup plans or so many disaster recovery plans that are like that, which are, we've got a plan for it, but we don't do anything to verify. Francisco, what are the things that enterprises need to do to verify that their recovery plans are actually working?
One of the best things to do is actually go through the restore process. We have a customer that is a bank, and they actually every month they go through a restore. They randomly select one of the backups they've done from their many servers, and they go through the restore both back to a virtual environment and to a physical environment. So they actually test that disaster recovery backup that they've been doing. So that's the easiest thing to do, and that's the best way to do it, is actually do your due diligence and actually do the restore.
Curtis, why don't more enterprises and businesses do due diligence on backup recovery? Is it just a cost and time thing, or is it not even considered?
I think that for some, cost and time enter into it. But for, I think, a greater number, it's that they don't want to admit that they're vulnerable. If you really practice business recovery, recovery of your backups, on some level, you're admitting that a disaster could occur. And as human beings, a lot of us just don't like to admit that. It's the same reason that people resist buying life insurance. You know, when you buy life insurance at some level, you're admitting to the possibility that you could someday not be here. And that's tough for many, many people. I think that considering the possibility is something that's important in a lot of senses. You find out when a disaster does occur that insurance can be pretty cheap. Going through the process of making sure your backups work is something that has a low, low per incident cost versus the extraordinarily high incident cost of a backup that doesn't work or no backup at all.
Chibert, we've got Cabo Zone in the chat room saying that our backups are only as good as the last time we verified them. We have another, I've already scrolled past, one of the web users who essentially said, well, why do you have an intern doing your backups? Which is kind of flippant, but they both strike to a very good point, which is this costs money. And, you know, if I'm not going to pay a high paid employee to sit and verify my backups. I'm not going to use an engineer to make sure that my tapes are copying over properly or that my Blu-ray discs are copying over properly. But we do need to verify. We do need to make sure that these things work. We do need to take that ounce of prevention to prevent the pound of cure. So to you, what's sort of the secret sauce to make sure that people put backup as a priority?
I don't know. It's been one of those age-old problems. How do you get people to realize that they're investing in their future? I don't have an answer. You know, you try all kinds of things. You do passive-aggressive. You do carrot sticks. I haven't found a way yet to get people to really realize just how important backups and verifying backups are until they've lost data. And that's an awful painful way to learn a lesson. I'm actually thinking I should toss this over to Francisco because one of the reasons why I actually went with Paragon Software for my backup solution was that it had the ability to go and re-verify tapes, backup media, and also that. And I love their Paragon Partition Manager because it makes migrating laptops so much easier. Francisco, you know, why don't you talk a little bit about the validation process that Paragon builds into their backup system?
Yeah. Thank you, Brian. Yeah. Part of our solution is actually during the backup process, we verify the integrity of the archive. It's a default setting. You can turn it off. It does, you know, speed up the backup a little bit. But, you know, we prefer that you have it on. And it just verifies that you're going to have a good backup when everything's all said and done. We also have the capability to take that same archive and after the fact go and check it. So if, you know, part of your process can be, you know, going through, you know, months worth of backups and, you know, and test them to make sure that they're valid. You can mount the archives so where you can actually see the data that's within those archives. So you can, you know, actually see, you know, what data is contained within. So we have lots of kind of checks and balances built into our solutions to verify that integrity because, you know, we don't want you to find out at the end when it's time to restore that, you know, there's nothing to restore. So we put those processes in the backup process and give you that ability to do it afterwards for a little bit of peace of mind.
You know what? I want to evolve this a little bit, and I'm going to start with Curtis. And what I'd like you to do is describe your three levels of preparedness. So what is the minimum that you have to do to prepare? So the lowest cost, the least amount of resources that you're going to spend, what would be your mid-range, and then what would be your ideal type of disaster preparedness program within, let's call it a large enterprise? Curtis, to you.
Well, I think that your bare minimum is standard tape backup the three levels of tape, rotate A, B, C, you know, take care of sort of the blocking and tackling of backup. Level two would be the warm backup site. Now, this is one where you have a contract such that if anything happens to your physical infrastructure, you have a second site where you can take your backup tapes along with your critical personnel, go there, and within a reasonable period of time, usually somewhere between 12 and 36 hours, you can be up and running again from a remote location with at least your essential functions. The top level would be the hot backup. This is a fully redundant backup site where all of your critical transactions are mirrored on a constant basis, such that in the case of an absolute disaster, either through a manual process of doing what's known as hitting the big red switch, or an automatic process when some disruption in your primary site is noted, everything switches automatically to this geographically separated hot backup site. Now, obviously, that third costs a lot more than simply having your tapes. But if every transaction is critical, let's say if you are a large bank, a large financial trading company, and you live and die by second-by-second transactions, then that third level is absolutely where you have to be.
Francisco, I want to go to you next. So if I'm talking about my three levels of protection based on three levels of expenditure, what would you see as your best practices for each of those levels?
My thoughts would pretty much mirror Curtis's. You know, definitely a local backup is the first step. And then, you know, a secondary step can be, you know, offsite, whether it's cloud-based or secondary location where, you know, if, you know, you can send personnel or you can convert those backups that are in the cloud to, you know, virtual machines that are in the cloud. You know, and then the third level, you know, the hot location or even a complete virtualized, you know, solutions running in the cloud. You know, definitely one of those options would be the best for the third tier there. Again, they're more expensive because of the, you know, the availability. But, you know, if your business depends on that being up and running, then it's a necessity.
Cheever, to you, I know that your environment is slightly different because it's partially academic. So what would be your three layers of ideal protection?
Actually, my three layers actually aren't really that different. It's data, regardless of whether it's coming off the ocean floor or coming out of a bank machine. I'm actually want to give a shout out to the Microsoft storage server guys because they actually have a really nice secondary way. I still like doing traditional backups and Francisco, I love the Paragon product and that's what I standardize on. But the concept of having a server that plays like a NAS, you can mount it iSCSI, SMB, whatever's, and you can actually flag folders and say after a certain amount of time, take it from online storage to nearline storage, maybe the slower drives, maybe going from SAS or SSD drives over to SATAs, and then have the ability to then take it offline to, say, something like Blu-ray. I'm quite fond of that. That's one of the things that I'm trying to implement at the university so that we can more quickly and easily get access. The cool thing about something like the Blu-ray archiving system, say, from HIT Systems out of Germany, is that you after the file gets or directories get archived, the metadata still stays on the server and will just get archived to Blu-ray and perhaps might even get stuck on a shelf. But the second you touch the file, it'll go and say, please mount cartridge such and such, and it'll bring it back onto the NAS. Very cool concept, probably a really nice way of handling a lot of the day-to-day. Microsoft just didn't quite catch on how to market this, but it's still a very good product.
Francisco, I want to give you the last word on this. When we talk about disaster recovery, when we talk about backup, A, is there anything that you think needs to be said that hasn't already been said in this episode? And B, what would be that final bit of encouragement that you'd want to get out there that might just push over that IT manager who's on the ledge about whether or not he's doing enough to be prepared for disaster recovery?
I mean, the first thing is just back up. I mean, it's the most important thing. You could probably turn on the news and see all the businesses in New Jersey and New York that have been devastated. You know, hopefully they had something, had something in place. But, you can see real world examples that, you know, disasters can happen to anybody. And you have to be prepared, definitely just having just a simple form of backup is the first step. And then expand on that.
Fantastic. Now, we've been talking a lot about backup. We've been talking a lot about putting our data in the cloud or into a public private cloud up in a server somewhere. I thought this might actually be a good time to talk about another one of our sponsors, because they let us at Twit do pretty much the same thing with our phone system. And of course, I'm talking about RingCentral. When Leo first built the brick house, they didn't want to have to deal with a bulky PBX. They didn't want to have to deal with a lot of equipment in the basement, with a lot of proprietary phones on desks. It just was something that they wanted to do without. And so when Russell, the IT guy, came to them and told them that they could have a cloud-based phone system, well, it was a no-brainer. You see, RingCentral is really phone in the cloud. We can customize all of our call handling, and there's zero startup costs. Our producers can get their voicemail in their emails, and we can get our fax messages right on our smartphones. The best thing is that we don't have to worry about that bulky PBX in the basement, because all the servers and all the services are on the web. They're in the cloud. They're managed somewhere else. All we have to do is use their easy-to-use user interface to set up the system to work the way we want it to work. And that's just unbeatable. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So why not call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980, and try it free for 30 days. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980. Or you can also go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I want to thank our panelists for hanging around for an hour of Twiet. Curtis, let's start with you. Is there anything going on in enterprise efficiency, anything in the coming weeks that you think Twiet listeners really should know about?
Well, I think there's one thing that everyone should know about, and that's that on Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern, we're going to have a special E2 radio show on gadgets, the various small bits of kit that go into the proper business accessory guide. And we're going to have our own favorite Twiet host, Father Robert Ballaser, as our guest. That should be very interesting. Next week, I will be reporting from Dell World in Austin, Texas. And just want to take a second. Today's a difficult day for me. One of the men who influenced me most passed away this weekend, and it affected me a lot, reminded me of just how important teachers are to all of us. So Mr. Bill Veazey is being laid to rest, actually, as we are taping this, and my heart goes out to his family and all of the thousands of students whose lives he had a dramatic impact upon.
If you want to talk a lot, you can become a politician. If you want to change the world, you can become a teacher. Cheever, let's go to you. What's going on in Paradise, and what projects do you have coming up that you think Twiet listeners need to know about?
Actually, I'm right after this taping, I'm going to be heading downstairs to my data center and working on bringing back a server that has died. So my suggestion for people is don't cheap out on the RAID controller. In this case, we got bit by a Dell Perk 300. It's fine for a small number of drives, but the second you have a customer or project that wants to go and fill up that server full of drives, you're going to start having drive failure. Don't cheap out on the controller. Get something good.
Cheebert, did you just call out Dell?
Yes, I did. Dell, the Perk 300 should never be sold. It's a piece of feyu.
This episode of TWiET was never brought to you by Dell. Let's go over to you, Francisco. Francisco, thank you so very much for coming on, for sharing your knowledge about backups, about disaster recovery. You know, tell us a little bit about Paragon Software. Tell us about what you're doing. Tell us about what we need to do and what we need to know when we're doing our backups right.
Thank you very much for having me. Here at Paragon Software, we provide disaster recovery solutions in addition to disk management solutions. Brian talked about our partitioning tool. So have lots of solutions even for Mac solutions. Again, disaster recovery, very important from the home user to enterprise. We provide solutions that will that can fit in any of those sectors there. Starting 2013, we'll be releasing a new enterprise product called our Protect and Restore, aimed at hybrid environments, virtual and physical environments that allow you to do backups and replications of VMs and physical systems. So looking forward to that.
Thank you. Thank you for being on. Thank you to all of our panelists. And thank you, that's right, our loyal listeners, for coming back time and time again and spending some time with us each Monday to, well, find out what's going on in the enterprise world. Now, I am a priest, so of course I can't send you back out into the real world without some announcements. The first has to be that we've got our question and answer show coming up very, very soon. If you go to twiet.reddit.com, you'll be able to see the questions that we currently have up in the queue, ready to get answered by our tremendous panelists. And we'll get your questions in now because we're just about to hit the deadline. We're going to start going through them and sorting out who wants to answer what. We've got everything from questions about DHCP to questions about SNMP, the network management protocol. We even got someone who wants to know what he should do if he wants to get involved in the IT world. It's going to be a fantastic episode, and we want to get input from you about what we should include. Also, subscribe. Why not? If you're listening to this in a download, why not have each episode of TWiET automatically delivered to whatever device that you want it delivered on? If you go to twit.com/TWiET, you can find all the different ways that you can have our episodes automatically delivered to your iPad, your iPhone, your Android device, your Mac, or your PC. And why not download a couple of editions? Get the audio version for your walk or your drive to work, and then get the high-definition goodness for when you want to cuddle up with a loved one, because nothing says love like enterprise tech. Okay, I just made that up. Also, why not follow me on Twitter? If you go to twitter.com/PadreSJ, you'll be able to find out what we're doing on each and every episode of TWiET. You'll be able to suggest topics for future episodes and even hosts. And yes, you can suggest that maybe you want to be on an episode and join the TWiET army. Also, did you know, Cheebert, let me ask you this. Did you know that we tape live?
I don't know. Am I live or am I Memorex?
Well, no. You're live. That's right. You are not Memorex. This is live right now, Mondays at noon, every single week. We're here to bring you all the goodness in the enterprise. So if you join us at live.twit.tv, Mondays, Pacific, noon, you'll be able to see us live and you'll be able to participate with our chat room, filled with some of the most brilliant engineers, some of the funniest trolls ever, and, well, just a great experiment in temporary community. That's it for this episode of TWiET. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep TWiET.